order, and where's my... There it is. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3510, and Janet, can you give us a rundown where we're at?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no new material this morning on 3510, no amendments. The bill would prohibit the Department of Transportation from making jurisdictional transfers of state highways conditioned on the a condition of moving forward with the modernization project. The hearing on this bill was on April 4th. You heard from cities, from counties, from the city of Grants Pass, and from ODOT about the bill. Because of the fiscal impact, you may want to hear from the Department of Transportation this morning about that, and Representative Anderson is here with additional information from the city of Grants Pass.
Representative Anderson, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gordon Anderson, representative from District 3, Grants Pass, Josephine County. I just wanted to enter into the record a letter that I received since our hearing. And let me just cut to the chase, a couple facts and figures that I think are important. This is from Robert Weber, Public Works Director in Josephine County. The salient part is, in recent years, and I will have a copy of this to you during your hearing this morning. I'm sorry I didn't have the copies. In recent years, Josephine County Public Works has been downsizing its staff and major road maintenance programs. We've cut staff by 10% this year, and we'll have to cut another 10% next year. We have also cut our annual chip seal resurfacing program by 60% in the last 2 years. The Public Works budget in 1991 was $11.4 million, and this year it's $9.0 million. Due to inflation, this year's $9 million will buy only $6.2 million worth of labor, materials, and equipment when comparing today's prices to 1991 prices when the last gas tax increase occurred. We are currently not able to provide adequate basic maintenance for our highways. Our county cannot afford to take on further road maintenance responsibilities, and efforts by ODOT to make this occur as a condition of proceeding with modernization projects is unreasonable and would shift to a large financial burden to local government. I'll get a copy of this to each of you members. My summation, I guess, would be we're not asking that jurisdictional exchanges not be allowed. We're asking that they not be mandatory, that they can be done voluntarily by a city that wants to help. But that should not force the project higher on the STIP. And actually, we're asking that we go back to the program that had been in place for many, many years, that you have a criteria, you go through the criteria, the top projects get done. And through rules here recently, ODOT has been saying, well, if you'll give us some money, we'll move it higher. I think that's unfair to some of the smaller counties, and I would encourage you to pass this to the floor with a due pass.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Honor.
Chair, how much difference in money are we talking about? How much are they willing to offer, and how much...
Well, it really depends on the Chair Brown and Representative Zoner. It really depends on the project. If Shady Cove is asking for, an extra lane going through town or something, it might be a couple hundred thousand. If it's the South Medford interchange, it could be $30 million. You know, that a lot of money could be requested.
Follow up, I thought there was a bridge that maybe that you wanted to build that was involved, and then you were going to have to take so many miles of a highway that you'd have to maintain, or is that a different?
We did a couplet in town. It's the main. It's 199 going down to the coast that goes right through downtown Grants Pass. That was done about 2 years ago for $11.1 million. And our city manager, I believe, gave you the figures on that. It came out, I believe, in 20 years that we had to come up with more than $20 million as an exchange, and that just was really unable to be done. There's another, the bridge, fourth bridge over the Rogue River. There was to be an exchange of the upper river, lower river loop And I don't have the dollar figure with me, Representative Zunner, at this point. I think that's in your testimony. But it was more than the city felt that we could come up with over the 20-year, 30-year period of time for maintenance. And I think we need to go back to essentially going back to increasing the gas tax at some point in the future so we do have the monies to do these maintenance projects and not do an unfunded mandate essentially on the counties and the cities.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mabry.
I think I know where you're going and why you want to get there, and it makes sense to me, but I'm thinking back 100 years ago when I was a 16-year-old boy, and I thought I needed an automobile, and my dad said, okay, John, I'll get you the car, but you got to pay for your own insurance. That was a condition of me getting the automobile. And it was a good exchange. It was a good negotiating thing, and I made it work. And it seems to me what you're talking about here is ODOT saying, yeah, we want to help you with this bridge, but in order to do this, you've got to do this and so, because I don't have the money to do it all. Am I missing something here?
Well, I guess I would change it a little bit and say that's very true in terms of the city streets and the arterials and connectors. We feel a responsibility and have that responsibility to make those roads last forever. It's the state highways that we're talking about. The state has a responsibility for that, and they're now shifting it to the counties and cities and saying, here, you take it so we can go off and do another project. And I appreciate that. I think they've been trying to get more work done, more miles maintained, because they're under pressure. But it's a pressure because we as a legislature, not we, but others in the past, have not been able to increase the gas tax proportionally since 1991. And I think that's where the monies that are needed lie.
Representative Beyer.
Yes, and I'm not sure that this is a question that you can answer, but I remember in the public hearing that we had previously, and I asked Andrea point blank because I didn't think I was getting a clear answer about whether or not they supported the bill. She did come to my office afterwards to explain that she'd had right prior, they were supportive, but prior to the hearing, they'd had a discussion with ODOT, and it appeared that ODOT and the cities and counties were reading the bill differently. That ODOT was reading that this changed the way things were done, and the cities were saying that this pretty much just put into statute what was happening at this point in time. They didn't see any difference. So I've been, you know, divided about this issue anyway, and then I start wondering if people are getting different things out of this bill. That concerns me. So,
right.
I don't know whether there's anyone from the cities and counties that can answer that question. I know ODOT's here, but
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I think that the LOC and AOC are under a difficult strain because they're caught in between. For instance, Coos Bay actually said, yes, we will come up with money. Grants Pass said, we can't. Justine County is saying, we can't. And so they're caught between some that feel, well, it's okay. We don't like to have to do it because it is essentially shifting the cost to counties and cities instead of the responsibility that the state has. And on the other hand, there are people who are saying, no, please don't do it. So they've got people on both sides of the fence. There's a bill in the Senate, I believe, or I'm not sure that it's still alive, that Senator Metzger has that is authorizing this for the city of Sandy. And we're not against that. We're just saying, if you want to voluntarily go ahead and do it, fine, but don't mandate it. That's the unfortunate, unfunded mandate part, I think.
Representative Greenlight.
Gordon, thank you for coming again. I really would like to ask basically the same question I asked last time and get your sense again. I mean, it does seem to me if I'm sitting in a priority process and I have two projects, and they're basically equal projects, and one of them, Estacada says, oh, no problem, we'll pick up the maintenance on that project, And the other one, Grants Pass, says, no, we can't pick up the maintenance. Estacada is going to win the priority battle.
Right.
I mean, is that built in? Do you think that's true and still?
But,
I mean, and I'm talking about equal projects. They're not all equal, obviously.
And Chair Brown, Representative Greenlake, I guess that's the only way I could answer it, is that previously to this rule being written, or at least the trend happening, it was by the criteria in the STIP. There were, in the Rogue Valley Area Commission on Transportation, we had about 10 different criteria that you had to go through. That's where it ought to be. Now, if they really are equal, and Estacada, for instance, wants to put some money in, I'd say fine. But if they're not equal, and Grants Pass is number one, and Estacada is number five, and Estacada says, we got money and you don't, I don't think it should become number one.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Doug, could you
embellish it? Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Doug Tyndall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I think the conundrum has been pretty well explained by your questions and Representative Anderson. All I can add, I understand from Ms. Adkins that the fiscal did not reach your table. We did turn in a fiscal on this because there are projects contemplated in the upcoming statewide transportation improvement program that would transfer some number of miles, about 16 lane miles, to local jurisdictions that are currently state highways. And if those 16 lane miles are not transferred, we would have to pay for the maintenance on those miles. The total is around $212,000 a year. If we do transfer those miles, those monies would be available for the other high priority statewide routes that are around. So that's what our estimate of the impact, at least over the short term, of this bill is. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions, Doug? Representative Zahner.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, you and I talked about it. Might this be an opportunity for a partnership between private and public funds and try to, because you've got pavers that people could use, you know, maybe we can get somebody together here and kind of privatize it. I don't want to say that, but, you know, be more efficient, I guess.
Chair Brown, Representative Zahner, I think as we talked, the legislation that's moving that enables public-private partnerships may be one of the answers to the problem that we're facing right now. Basically, what those types of partnerships do is it's another way to get money into the system. And I think Representative Anderson portrayed this exactly correct. If everybody had enough money, this wouldn't be an issue. And the problem is nobody's got enough money. And if you can use private dollars in conjunction with public dollars, then I think some of the problems go away. We need that legislation. I think that'll be over here. The public-private partnership legislation will be over here, and that's something that we need, is another tool in the toolbox.
Representative Greenlake.
Doug, I would like to raise the same question I raised with Representative Anderson in a sense. I mean, I really have sympathy with the notion expressed here that if Estacada can't pick up the maintenance of the project, it can't pick up the maintenance of the project. But then the question is, doesn't that become a factor in the priority setting matter? I mean, it seems if you have two equal or near equal projects and one the money can be used somewhere else, the other it won't. I mean, isn't that an inevitable consequence of this?
Chair Brown, Representative Greenlake, what I hear Representative Anderson saying is he doesn't want, if you have a project that would otherwise be funded, he's reluctant to have the ability to buy yourself up past that project. I think the problem is that you point out that without that, it's not a case of number five passing number one when you can only fund three. It's more of a case of maybe those projects don't ever get to number one. and that through a jurisdictional transfer makes them attractive. So I can understand where Representative Anderson, I understand his point. There's nothing wrong with what he's saying, but it is a factor. It is a factor by law. It's not Representative Anderson referred to rules. It's actually a factor by law in the OTIA project selection that preference be given to projects that facilitated the jurisdictional transfer.
Any other questions, Doug? Thank you, Doug. Is there anyone else here this morning who wanted to testify or give us input on House Bill 3510? It would, committee, it would appear to me with the physical impact of $210,000 or $212,000 that it'll require a referral to Ways and Means. So I would entertain the motion.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 3510 to Ways and Means if it do pass.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Zahner moves House Bill 3510 to the Ways and Means with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
That's
Janet?
That's adding
and, yes, and that's adding,
adding
with the referral.
Whatever you say.
Okay.
Fine with me.
No further discussion. Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Okay, 2261. Yeah. Well, the committee, the House bill, and if there's anyone here to testify on House Bill 2749, those are going to be, it'll be held over till this afternoon along with 2455 and 2388 and 2986.
Not get too many.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. House Bill 2455 will be held over till Friday. Let's see, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2661, and Janet, can you
give
us a rundown?
This bill is a gut and stuff of a bill that would have required the Department of Transportation to ensure access to Klamath Community College. The Dash 2 amendments are new this morning at your place. This bill authorizes the Department of Transportation to arrange for the removal of a vehicle from the right-of-way of a state or interstate highway. If you remember the issue from last week, the department has been authorizing tows under delegation from the state police. The state police was recently advised that they should not be delegating that to another agency. So this gives the Department of Transportation authority to tag and arrange for the tows of vehicles. It's not an additional fiscal because this is what the department has been doing with their comet response vehicles. This is Representative Greenlee's amendment, and the department's here if you have any questions.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes, sir. This gotten stuff with the kind permission of Representative Girard, who no longer needed 2661 for his purposes, came about as a result of my doing an ODOT comet ride-along and finding abandoned cars along the stretches of I-5. And when inquiring about it, it turned out that ODOT used to have given from the state police the authority to tag and to arrange for the tow of cars off the freeway. There was an opinion, Attorney General's opinion or something came up, and it caused OSP, and also some technical issues, caused OSP to withdraw that authority from ODOT. We went back and investigated the situation, met with ODOT and with OSP. They would be quite happy to have the statute amended as is in 2661-2, to give them the authority to tag and to arrange tows. And then they'll notify OSP, who will follow through on the procedures for possessionary liens and the things that have to go on after that. But this just gives ODOT the right to get those cars out of the off the freeway side lanes and other places. ODOT, incidentally, always has the authority to tow a car off when it's blocking traffic. That's not an issue here. This is just the ones abandoned at the side of the road. And I think ODOT and OSP are both very comfortable with it.
Thank you, Representative. Is there anyone from the department want to testify on it? Shrugs and shaking of the head.
And thumbs up.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2661.
Representative Greenlick moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2661. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? They're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House 2661 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlick moves House Bill 2661 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlick.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Having learned my lesson, I could recommend this to the consent agenda, or I'd be happy to carry it.
Okay. What's the committee think? It looks like they're nodding of the head. Huh? Okay, I have Representative Greenlick moves that it be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar.
See, I learned.
Mr. Chair, the fiscal statement on House Bill 3510, the bill we just sent to Ways and Means, just arrived, so Brian's passing that out if you want to.
The printer's got to be faster than that, don't they? On the votes. There's somebody here to testify on that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2685, or no, and a work session. And we lost the...
Oh,
there he is. Ken, would you come forward, please? It's pretty hard to believe that we'd overlook such a little guy like you.
Yeah, that happens to me all the time.
Jen will give us a rundown here on where we're at with this, and then we'll let Ken testify.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is the bill that, House Bill 2685 is the bill that would authorize courts to remove and dispose of abandoned boats, floating homes, and boathouses, and it created a cleanup account for abandoned boats. When a dollar fee increase on boat, the biennial boat license. But you have in front of you the dash two amendments, and we just received them this morning. They modify the biennial fee amounts to be a dollar for boats under 26 feet, $5 for boats 16 feet and longer, and $10 for commercial boats that are assessed by the Department of Revenue. The other major thing that the dash twos do is make any amount that's collected by that surcharge above $150,000 go into the facility's grant account to be spent for other boating purposes for marine areas and docks and things like that. So the $150,000 would be an amount spent biennium on abandoned boats.
Is that where the other money usually goes? Is that the account to which fees usually go?
Some of the money goes there, and I don't know if Paul Don has
to that.
So the proponent might be able to answer that question about the other funds. The other thing I wanted to point out is that we did receive notice from Legislative Council when we picked up the amendments that the amendments do not fit the relating clause of the bill because the money would not all be going to abandoned boats, and the relating clause on the bill is abandoned boats. So we may be need to talk about it and either bring it back this afternoon or at a future date.
Go ahead, Ken.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. On that last point, quite frankly, we're a little bit perplexed. We've not seen a situation where legislative counsel puts out the amendment and then says we think there's a problem with the relating clause. So as Janet and I were conferring prior to the start of the hearing, we weren't exactly sure what that meant. So we're gonna continue to talk a little bit about that and figure out what needs to be done. Obviously, we don't want to put your committee or the body in a situation where you're moving amendments into a bill where the relating clause doesn't fit. But that as it is, the purpose of the Dash 2s are to go along, to be a companion with the Dash 1s. The Dash 1s deal with all the technical corrections that we had identified at the last hearing, dealing with changing the amounts of the fees, as Janet has described. The Dash 2s were our attempt to work with representatives of the Northwest Steelheaders Association, as representing recreational boating interests, to try and come up with a way that makes them comfortable with it. And it is our impression that these Dash 2s accomplish that by providing some of the money that would be coming off those boat registration fees into the facility grant program. That's a win-win for everyone as far as we're concerned. That is a concept that the Marine Board has no problem with. At least that's how they've described it to us. As near as I can tell, the only issue we have right now is whether or not we do have, in fact, a relating clause problem here. If we do not, then this is a bill that's ready to go and no opposition. If we do, we either need to find another way to tweak these amendments or identify another vehicle that's got a different relating clause. So I apologize for putting the committee in that awkward situation this morning. Frankly, we don't know what that all means, but we think we are getting closure around the technical parts of the bill anyway. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ken. Representative Donner.
First for Janet, is there a fiscal on this at all?
Mr. Chair, there is, and this does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. How do the steelheaders and the fishermen feel about the bill?
We're going to find out.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I get to speak right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. As you may recall, we came forward with concerns about the fairness of how these monies were going to be raised and how those monies would then be distributed. We sat down, and I sat down with the approval of my board to try and figure out something that was perhaps a more equitable sharing of the benefits that these dollars would be raising. So just very quickly, you'll recall that, and I think you asked me the question directly, Representative Mabry, with regards to, well, does it help that the ports are providing a matching? And the answer is yes, it does. As you recall from the original legislation, 75% of the funding for a project would be put up from this account, and then 25% would be matched by the ports. Well, with the belief of, or with the Dash 2 amendments, as you see, it caps that at $150,000. Thereby, if that were all to be utilized, you would see $50,000 then coming in from the ports to help remove these derelict vessels. Now, as you've heard testimony, a lot of these are commercial rigs. Some of them are recreational rigs. So we want to acknowledge straight up that all of these, or that these projects have the potential to benefit all users. But the other thing is that we would expect that we would be raising about $200,000 in each biennium under these Dash 2 amendments. What you would essentially, by capping it at $150,000, you would be making an additional $50,000 available to, again, the general improvements of facilities across the state benefiting all users. So that was kind of the rationale that went into working on this. It's not perfect, but it does help share benefits to all users who are contributing to this fund. So we think that, you know, frankly, we want to have world-class facilities. That's better for economic development. That's better for tourism. Those are both things that are winners for Oregon.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Sounds like Thank that. And committee will close the hearing on the House Bill 2685 and look for a vessel for this vessel bill to fix a problem. Okay. Okay, we'll open the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3187. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3187 would specify the ballot title for Senate Joint Resolution 14, which, if approved by voters, would delete a reference to mobile homes in the Oregon Constitution, a provision of the Constitution that deals with taxes and fees on motor vehicles. It's a little bit unusual to be doing the ballot title before you've seen the resolution. The resolution is in the Senate and has been sent to the Ways and Means Committee. The ballot title bill, this bill, needed to be introduced, but it did not make the Senate deadline for introduction, which is earlier than the House deadline, so it was introduced as a House bill instead. So that's why you have the House bill, and since we're bumping up against the deadline, we decided to go ahead and do it, because the Senate bill went to the Ways and Means Committee, not straight over to us, Senate resolution. So this is a ballot title. The statute authorizes the legislature to write ballot titles for any measures that they refer to the ballot. I included a page from an old voter's pamphlet to show you what the ballot title in the voter's pamphlet looks like. It's the shaded area on the example was Measure 87 from the 2000 election. So the ballot title includes the title, which is called the caption, the result of a yes and result of a no vote, and then a short summary of the bill. So the legislature, that's what 3187 does. You have the dash one amendments that modify the wording somewhat, and we did a hand engrossed version of the dash one amendment so you can see how it appears in the bill.
Janet?
Yes.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of how much we're talking about as far as the collection? I understand that it's just going to be used for a different purpose.
Right.
But do you have a sense of how much we're talking about? I don't see any fiscal.
There isn't a fiscal because the ballot title does not affect that. The my understanding of the effect on parks is in the tens of thousands of dollars. If to the highway fund on the order of 100 or 200,000, but or more than that. The issue is that this program may be being transferred to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Instead of having a manufactured structure, a home titled by DMV, they're going to go to the DCBS, so that's where the fees would go. Kelly Taylor and Don Miner are here, Department of Transportation and Manufactured Housing. you can read on the background what SBR 14 does and why, and they can speak or I can answer questions.
Okay. Thank you, Janet. I noticed looking at the subject on the example you use for a ballot title. I think I want to make sure I clearly understood that has nothing to do with the issue that we're dealing with today. Representative Greenlee.
I'm a little perplexed as to why this is here rather than, say, either Ways or Means, which is considering the measure itself, or Judiciary, which I assume knows something about writing ballot titles.
We'll get Don Miner up here, and he'll explain some of that. It is more than a little confusing. Morning, Don.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of this measure as amended with the Dash 1 amendments. This bill is part of a package of legislation that transfers responsibilities for regulation, titling, registration, and regulation of manufactured home dealers from DMV over to the Building Codes Division. Had we been a little quicker on our toes, it would have been a Senate bill, and you would have seen a whole package, and it would have made more sense. So we apologize to you for that. Just by way of background, the House Interim Transportation Committee worked with a work group that was made up of ourselves, county assessors, county recorders, consumers, lenders, ODOT, building codes, etc., to restructure the way manufactured homes are regulated. That measure is Senate Bill 468, and that also is down in the Ways and Means Committee. And what it does is essentially just takes those duties from DMV and puts it in building codes. As we were looking at that, though, we discovered that the Oregon Constitution, by reference to mobile homes, and I've given you a copy of that the relevant constitution, SGR 14 sets out that language, would have left or had the potential of leaving some of the revenues back at ODOT. And so the purpose of SGR 14 was to ensure that the revenues follow the responsibilities. That's actually all that it does. The amendment was also done at our instigation. As written, the bill says that result of a yes vote would allow these monies to be used for any purpose, pizza, balloons, dancing girls. I'm not sure we would have voted for that. And I also don't believe that it accurately reflects what would happen with these monies. If Senate Bill 468 were to pass, SGR 14 were to pass, the monies would go to DCBS, where they are actually would be dedicated to manufactured housing purposes. So they would have been there, could only be used for the program purposes related to manufactured housing. And so our request was to have the bill amended to make it a little bit more accurate in how these monies will be used. And we're saying just non-highway purposes. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Don. Representative Beyer.
Thank you. Basically, what you're saying is this is going to go into general fund or not? Is it going to be more specific than general fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the monies are fees that are collected. They're collected by the state agency as a matter of their statutory framework. Those programs are dedicated to being used for the manufactured home programs they regulate. So I assume the legislature could use those monies for some other purpose, but I think they're generally considered other funds.
Follow-up? So it would be your intent that maybe these fees follow into DCBS? Is that the right acronym here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, exactly, and that they only be used for the manufactured home program.
Thank you.
Just sort of by way of explanation, the way the program works now is when a person registers his manufactured home, he pays a fee into the highway fund to support roads, state parks and recreation areas. I think if somebody even goes off into county parks, and that's probably a good thing that those programs are supported. It's probably not fair that manufactured homeowners have this hidden tax on them. And so one of the consequences of this is that would go away as well.
Any other questions, Don? This issue, I remember from last session, was a difficult one to deal with and handle, and your work group has been put a lot of time in making accomplishing this. Well, start to bring it to this point, yeah.
Mr. Chair, your able committee administrator put a great deal more work into it than we did.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Is anyone else here to testify on 3187? Kelly's shaking her head. No. Okay, we're in a work session, aren't we? Okay. Yeah, we need to adopt amendment first, right? I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dashwood amendments to the bill.
Representative Mabry moves the Dashwood amendments to 3187. Is there any objection? there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so done. And this could, does it have to go to Ways and Means, or?
Mr. Chair, the referral to Ways and Means would keep it with the rest of the bills, but it's still going to come out separately because they'll come out on the Senate side first, yeah. And this will come out on the House side first, so it's going to be hard to match up either way. Just wanted to remind people that nothing, this has no effect if the resolution doesn't move forward, because of course there's no ballot title for the bill. So this in itself is just the wording for the ballot title if it passes, if the legislature passes it on to voters.
Representative Greenland.
I'd still like a little more information. I mean, I have a sense of we're going to add the 354th Amendment to the Oregon Constitution based on this ballot title, and the responsibility in terms of the technical responsibility for the ballot title gives me a moment of pause. Do we assume by the fact that this came through our legislative council that it meets the legal requirements for a ballot title? I mean, for a ballot title, it seems to me, if I'm on a ballot title, judiciary ought to have something to say about whether this is making sense. And I'm not worried about the substantive content, I'm worried about the technical provisions of the ballot title.
Well, I assume it does, yeah.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, the wording was drafted by legislative council, and they did accept the changes that were proposed by the work group. And as the background in the SMS states, that if the legislature does not write a ballot title for a measure they refer, the attorney general, it falls to the attorney general to write the ballot title. So if you don't do anything, there is a ballot title that's written by the attorney general. And the other reason I put the page from the old voters pamphlet is to show you that there's also the text of the measure is also written out below the ballot title. The explanatory statement is in the voters pamphlet, and that's written by a committee, two opponents, two proponents, and a fifth member chosen by the four people. And then the legislature also has a chance to write an argument in support, and that's the next thing in the voters' pamphlet. And then the purchased pages for support or opposition. So the ballot title is what appears on the ballot itself and the first part of the voters' pamphlet.
Including line 18 through 20.
Yes, Representative Greenman.
I would entertain a motion to move the bill to the floor as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3187 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilman moves House Bill 3187 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, is there any more discussion? All the questions answered. Hearing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Excuse.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries, and entertain the motion to put it on the consent calendar. I don't want to have to try to explain it. Representative Greenlick moves that it be placed on the consent calendar. Any objection? So done.
Won't get me to object.
You learned your lesson.
Me neither. I learned from your lesson.
Okay, we're down to... want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2039. And Janet, can you give us a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2039 was introduced at the request of the House Interim Transportation Committee and would require a safety inspection of intermodal truck chassis before the chassis are driven out of a port. It would permit the driver of the truck tractor to request reinspection of the chassis before it left the port, and would prohibit removing or tampering with inspection tags, creating a violation that's punishable up to a year in prison and a $5,000 fine. It also would prohibit retaliation against a driver who requests reinspection, creating a violation that's punishable by up to 30 days imprisonment and a $1,000 fine. You also, Mr. Chair, have -1 amendments to House Bill 2039 that would further define what a defect is and place it as a condition that constitutes a violation of the North American Uniform Vehicle Out-of-Service Criteria. The amendments would require the inspectors who perform the inspection to be trained and certified as commercial vehicle inspectors by ODOT, and would delete a provision in the original bill that required immediate reporting to ODOT of defects that pose imminent danger. Mr. Chair, the issue here is that the truck driver may own the chassis and be responsible for that and its safety, but they pick up the tractor. They pick up the chassis at the port that they do not own, but they become responsible for inspections and tickets once they take it down the road. And, Mr. Chair, there's a witness list.
Thank you. Janet, could I have Lynn Lirbach and Greg Delpon both up here, please? Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
You?
Just fine. Would you like me to go first?
Yeah, why don't you go first?
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to appear before this committee. We did appear before the interim committee on December 3rd and presented quite a bit of information. I hope you still all have your packets and pictures.
I think, Lynn, these were probably all new people except for myself. They're all a new committee.
Well, so, I have them, but I don't have them.
Yeah. I was on interim, but I probably don't have them with me. But
Representative Zahner was on the other committee. But I apologize for not having it available for you. Yes, would you please? And that's my misunderstanding of why I was here this morning. As a matter of fact, I wasn't going to go through my entire testimony, Mr. Chairman. I can.
Why don't you go ahead and tell your story, and I bet you can do it without having a
moment. Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will submit the written comments, but what I'll do is I'll briefly go over it, Mr. Chairman, if I can. And this involves the hundreds of trucks that haul containers out of our ports here in Oregon, and we were concerned about the safety of the driving public and of our drivers that take these out on the highways every day. The present inspection system is flawed terribly. It's inadequate, does not meet the needs that we would all be concerned about. It's done very quickly. It's done in passing. My brothers from the longshoremen were here with me last time and gave you hands-on testimony and evidence as to their participation in this. They have two people assigned to go through this yard and do the inspections that are tagged. Some are, some aren't. I'm going to give you a process. When a truck driver comes into the port, as Janet has said, they come with a tractor. They go and get a chassis, which is designated to them by the longshoreman. The clerk will tell them where to go get the chassis, and the chassis must line up with the owner of the container. But when they go to this chassis yard, which I have toured, the unrepaired chassis and the roadworthy chassis are all stacked in a row. Some are tagged, some aren't tagged. The driver, because of the economy situation that he faces, he's rushed and pushed. He will grab the first chassis that he thinks is okay, makes a quick inspection, pulls out, goes over and gets a container, and then comes back through a line. Now, when I say inadequate, it's inadequate to say the least. And why? Because the port number one is only reimbursed by the foreign-owned Malto conglomerates that own that. They own the container and they own the chassis. They're only stored on the property. The port is reimbursed for some repairs, but they're very limited to the amount of time they can spend on the repairs. The port will then go to an outside contractor at times and bring them in to do some of the more major parts of the repairs. What we pointed out to you, and there are some pictures in there that are being passed around, is the port has a facility, a very large facility, and very qualified mechanics to do these repairs, but they don't do them. They're not authorized to do them. That's a flaw. Guess I'm skipping around here, but let me point out that these containers also aren't weighed, so we don't know the weight when it's put on the chassis. They don't know the weight at all. They aren't using the scales at the present time at the ports. So that, again, goes out on the road. And if the chassis is cracked or flawed in any way, that additional weight or the normal 80,000 pounds that they're carrying could either break the chassis or cause pieces of it to fly out. In my last testimony, and I'll make sure you have copies of this, we pointed out that in one incident, six children were killed because a piece of a chassis flew off of a truck, off the chassis, come up under a van, broke the fuel tank, the van exploded, and six children were killed. Another one right on our I-5 in Portland, a set of duals came off the chassis, jumped over the freeway, hit a car coming the other way, crashed through the windshield, and killed the driver. Now, there are other incidents. Those are two very serious incidents that I point out to you. Can we afford to allow equipment like that on the road? Plus the fact that this equipment, overweighted at times, just beats up our roads terribly. I mean, we got a hard enough time, I was just listening to the other testimony, and we did the last time we were here, of trying to raise money to keep our roads in good working condition. Well, this doesn't help, for sure. We talked about regulation. There are federal regulations. They're not enforced. Rulemaking has been going on since 1997. On these types of issues, plus hours of service, they're reconvening back there now. But what we were saying to you was we need local legislation, we need local authority for that port to be able to enforce some of these things that are going on. You cannot allow any kind of a vehicle on the road that we're knowledgeable about that's going to endanger the driving public. It may be your family that gets hurt. I certainly don't want mine to get hurt out there. But it's the system itself that is so rushed, so demanding, that no one is taking care. No one's watching. That's why we ask that state adopt legislation. Just a further comment. You know, we export our jobs by the thousands, by the hundreds. That's why this state's in trouble, incidentally, on its tax structure. We can export our jobs, but we import thousands of pounds, millions of containers back in this country from foreign countries, and we're going to allow that to come back and endanger our public by making sure that it isn't safe, that it isn't cared for. Something's wrong here. And We feel the need, see the need, and thought this bill was going to the floor, Mr. Chairman. You know, when we met with you and Mr. DuPont, we amended that bill so that there would be certified state inspectors to do this job. That's the importance of it. Not just haphazardly would this be done. These people would be certified by the state. They'd be trained. They'd know what to look for. And we could eliminate 99.9% of the problems that exist today. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll answer any questions or anything
you,
the
man.
Committee has.
Thank you. Any questions? The representative's honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're talking about the safety of the chassis, right? Not that container. It's the chassis.
It's a combination, though, Mr. Chairman. Representative Zahner, it's a combination because the chassis gets the container put on it when it's coming out, so it's combined. We have to be concerned about both, but the main part of our focus was on the chassis because it's the body that carries it.
Right, and when they take it into the shop to inspect it, they would do the chassis and they wouldn't be taking the container in that same shop at the port that you talked about to have the inspections.
Again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, they don't take them in the shop.
Oh.
They are put in rows out on a dirt base out in the port's property, and that's where they're looked at, and that's where they're repaired. Very seldom do they take one into the shop because taking it into the shop requires an amount of downtime, and the shipping container owners, the foreign-owned companies, won't allow enough time to spend on that chassis, so they don't take them into the shop. We're saying the shop's available, but they don't use it.
One follow-up. But if the truck driver said, "Hey, I want to take this into the shop and have it looked at," could they?
No, he don't have the authority. Now, if he spots one that's really faulty, yeah, he can say, "I'm not taking that container."
Okay.
You know, if he spots it, but he don't always catch them either.
Thank you.
Any other questions on it? Greg, I'd like to give your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Greg Delpani. I'm the administrator for the Motor Carrier Division of ODOT. Janet invited me this morning to come and revisit the brief testimony that I provided to the interim committee on this subject. And I think I can do that very quickly by observing that House Bill 2039, as it was originally drafted, was technically flawed. And it was flawed because it failed to distinguish between a motor carrier and a shipper. And I'll speak to that in just a moment, but that's an important distinction. The Dash 1 amendments have corrected those technical problems, and as currently drafted, they are satisfactory and accomplish the intended purpose. The bill itself is geared solely to ports engaged in the loading and unloading of ocean-going vessels that carry intermodal containers. A container being a cargo box that is secured to a chassis and then transported by a tractor, a truck, as a tractor-trailer combination. The description of the process you've received is somewhat indicative of the problem. Most of the time when a shipper calls a motor carrier and asks the motor carrier to transport their product, the motor carrier arrives with a tractor trailer. And the product is placed in or on the trailer and it's transported. This case is a little bit different. In this case, the shipper is providing not only the product, the container, but they're also providing the chassis, which is synonymous with the trailer. The container on the chassis is equal to the trailer that a tractor typically pulls. The motor carrier is the owner-operator that pulls up and lines up outside the port early in the morning, and they wait in line, and they're just the tractors, and they're waiting to be matched up with a already loaded up container on a chassis typically. So, the Department of Transportation and our federal counterparts, we have regulatory authority over motor carriers. I don't have regulatory authority over shippers, and therein lie the basic flaws with the bill as originally drafted. Is there a problem? Yes. I shared with the interim committee that my perspective as a regulator and also from a dozen years in the trucking industry, actually as a lessor of chassis to steamship lines, I'm intimately familiar with the operation of the shipping terminals. And I can tell you that there is a maintenance problem associated with chassis. That's a true statement. In fact, while we do not inspect chassis at the ports, we do have occasion to check them as they pass through our facilities on the interstate system. And I checked on the data for purposes of this morning's discussion, and I can tell you that when I looked at inspection records that were chassis containers, vehicle 2, the chassis, there was a 56% out of service average rate, and that's roughly twice the national average for tractor-trailer combinations. On the same hand, I'll tell you, though, that there is not any significant representation of chassis and containers in vehicle accident statistics. But there is a maintenance problem, and I think the data supports that. One thing you should be aware of on 2039 is that at least half of the container chassis traffic that's being transported on I-5 and 84 is not only originating from the ports, it's also originating from railheads. And House Bill 2039 does not address the rail component of this problem. So this legislation is one way to go to address the maintenance and the safety issue that you've heard about. But it's not the only alternative. The adoption of a consensus federal regulation has advantages over a quilt work, if you will, of individual state laws passed around the nation, which may or may not result in a uniform regulation. And there is a currently open docket on the USDOT system, and there is a significant body of discussion that's currently transpiring on this subject. The comment period is closing this month. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is being urged to begin a negotiated rulemaking to write a national federal rule that will address this issue. They had been delaying giving opportunity to a working group of interested private sector organizations to come to terms on this. In reviewing some of the comments that have been recently submitted on the open federal docket, I see that the party that actually requested the postponement to allow the dialogue, the American Association of Railroads, has thrown up its hands and said, we're hopelessly deadlocked. We're not going to come to individual agreement. We would appreciate the federal government beginning a rulemaking process to yield a national consensus rule. So those are the options before you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Then, Greg, you feel that the federal regulations would get at this issue and solve the problem, or give you the tools to solve the problem?
Mr. Chairman, as a matter of fact, I've previously described to this committee the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. It's an advisory body that was actually created by the legislature as a from a budget note appended to Senate Bill 1149. This advisory group, consisting of trucking associations, state police, and other parties that are participant to transportation issues in Oregon, has prepared a resolution which has recommended to the United States Department of Transportation that they begin this federal rulemaking for the purpose of creating a nationally uniform resolution to the problem. And, yes, I do believe it would address the issues.
What kind of time frame do you think would ballpark estimate?
Mr. Chairman, I am notoriously no good at predicting the timelines at which the federal government will work.
Okay.
I think we can fairly say that there is a consensus of opinion that the negotiated rulemaking appears to be necessary, so it will commence. I don't know what kind of timelines they will put on that process.
Representative Byer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If this bill were to pass here, how would that interconnect with
the federal process? Would it supersede it? Would there be any impact at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, I think the best way I can answer that is to tell you that there's a federal regulation, a federal law, that says that the states can't adopt laws that are inconsistent with a federal law that applies to interstate movement of vehicles. So to the extent that this bill ended up being inconsistent with a yet-to-be-written federal standard, to the extent it conflicted in, with regards to interstate, it could be subject to preemption, and we'd be looking at a situation similar to what we dealt with on House Bill 2217 and the NICSAP program, for instance. And so it's difficult to answer the question prospectively.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Donner.
On these inspections, how many were taken out of service when you know, like down in Woodburn, when you inspect the truck or when you find out that the chassis, did you repair it then? Did it stay there or could it still go? How severe was the problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Donner, whenever we do an inspection at, for example, at the Woodburn port of entry, depending on the severity of the defect, the vehicle is either allowed to proceed with a fix-it ticket, or if the defect rises to the level of severity that it is something that is listed on the out-of-service criteria that's embodied in our administrative rule, the vehicle is not allowed to proceed until it's repaired. And so it's a decision made on a case-by-case.
Follow-up. On these chassis that come from the port, what's the percentage of that are taken out of service? And I'm trying to find out how severe those problems are when they get to the checkpoints there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, of the container chassis vehicle combinations that were inspected, and I do not know the total number, I do know that 56% of those inspections resulted in the discovery of a defect that was serious enough to label it out of service.
Representative Greenland.
Greg, I'd like to follow up on Representative Byers' question. We pass this now. We're not passing anything that's in violation of a federal statute or a federal rule. So then a federal rule comes in, and it might preempt it or it might not. If it preempts it, then something else is in place. I mean, so there's no harm done by passing this. Is that right? I mean, it won't cause any confusion at this point since there is no federal rule.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, that is correct. We'll not be creating any obvious conflict if this law were to be passed.
Any other questions?
Could I add, Mr. Chairman? Thank you. I just in a failed to say that. But our sister state, California, has passed legislation already, and it's in effect down there. So they've already done something, and, you know, they passed safety, called it a roadworthy safety inspection program in the state of California. So they've already done it.
They still might want to do it. Is there a law to deal with this issue in Washington?
No. I know that it was presented up there. I don't know the result, Mr. Chairman. So I don't believe there's a law passed yet. I haven't been informed of one, and I would be yet.
Greg, is there a number of these containers originate out of the port of Seattle or Tacoma? I think a lot of the freight that's moving into Oregon probably originates up there. Is that true? Yeah. When you're inspecting these, maybe you can't determine where they started from.
Mr. Chairman, while inspecting the equipment, we're not typically aware of the point of origin unless we're doing a logbook check and we're examining the driver's comings and goings. But I can tell you from my private sector experience that steamship companies that typically own or lease these chassis, they're moving those chassis from a variety of ports. They're not necessarily domiciled. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. Sometimes in a roll-on, roll-off operation, the chassis are moving with the ocean-going vessel. Sometimes the chassis are domiciled at a particular port. So a given chassis could be moving up and down the western seacoast, Long Beach, Oakland, Portland, Vancouver, Seattle, or they could be domiciled by location. It depends on the operation of the particular steamship line.
And so it, the problem not wouldn't necessarily originate out of Port of Portland. It could have come from any port up and down the west coast that handles containers.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe that would be an accurate statement.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well,
I'm in his honor.
No, I think you answered it.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on? Janet?
There's a letter that was at your place today that I received as a fax yesterday from Jeffrey Lawrence, so enter that letter into the record.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we do have someone from the port, and I'd like to ask a question, if I could, regarding competition, because I had a letter here. I guess a couple of questions, and maybe I should ask it originally. How many more people would you have to hire at the port in order to accomplish this? And if nobody else has it going in Oregon or in Washington and California, do you lose a competitive edge, or how does that affect you?
California does have it, but do they have it in effect now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. To Representative Zahner's question, our analysis of this bill is that it would have a fiscal impact on the port of $3.4 million. And that would be in hiring inspectors through the Longshore Union who operates the dock. The issue around competitiveness is a significant one, and there is a law in California. There is not one in Washington, and to the extent you have additional requirements on steamship lines that ultimately hit the bottom line of your ability to provide the kind of services at the port that brings a steamship carrier up the river, which is always our challenge. We're a very small operation from a container standpoint than, say, L.A., Long Beach, Seattle, Tacoma. And so we are always challenged to provide the kind of critical mass of cargo and services at the least cost possible to bring these ships up the river and incent them to come and serve our market. And one thing I would remind the committee is we are really an export port. Our imports to exports is something like 4-to-1. It fluctuates. And what we export is cargo from almost every county in the state, from more than 1,000 businesses around the state. And so the ability to keep that container terminal competitive, keep it open, and keep it serving those businesses throughout the state, because it keeps transportation costs down, that's a significant economic and competitive issue for our state to think about. One other comment, just since I'm up here. The bill is flawed in one stance. There are some policy issues to consider, and I just mentioned that. The bill also only deals with Port of Portland. It deals with no one else who handle intermodal traffic. And we have off-dock container yards in Portland that compete directly with the Port of Portland for moving this traffic. We have, I don't know what the number is this year, but in a typical year, we call it leakage, but we lose somewhere around 50% of the containers that originate in this state will move up to Seattle and Tacoma through these off-dock yards. And that's something, frankly, we have a lot of strategies to try to get more of that traffic to come through the port because, again, it encourages steamship lines to come here and serve our market. This bill would not affect those off-dock rail yards or container yards, and that's a competitive disadvantage that we would face as a result of this legislation.
Thank you.
Representative Blair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is a pretty timid.
I know. I'm trying to get this. I mean, when you talk about a $3-point-something million impact in hiring and stuff, to me, I can't help but wonder if there's not some type of an impact when you have a 56% out-of-service rate on these containers that go out on the road, if they're pulling them out. And I don't know whether that would relate to your fiscal impact or whether that would relate to the container company's impact, but there has to be some type of a monetary impact there that you're maybe not accounting for.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, this is the first I've heard of that data, and I'm really not here to argue with the need or argue with the problem. I think we have concerns with the solution to the problem. And when you deal with international commerce, interstate movement of cargo, the federal government needs to deal with it. And it's unfortunate that they're not fast enough in dealing with it.
Representative Greenlee.
Hi, Keith. Could I talk just a moment about that $3.5 million estimate? That's about 70 FTEs or something. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, let me just qualify the fiscal. We were called by legislative revenue yesterday, and in a hurry, we came up with that number. It's based on, and I can break the number down. I'll have to get that from folks back at the port. But it's based on 700 moves a day that would have to be inspected because that's, I think, per day approximately. That's the number of chassis moves that under the bill, as we read it, would have to have some sort of inspection. I don't think it means 70 FTE. I don't know exactly.
50,000 out of the air as a...
Yeah, well, I would say 50,000 is a pretty low number for longshore.
All right, 100,000. 35 FTEs. So, I mean, your sense is there'd be 35 FTEs, 40 wandering around inspecting those chassis. Huh?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I didn't get an FTE number. I would have to get a breakdown of how we got to that number. My point is, instead of getting hooked up on a $3.4 million fiscal, there no doubt is a fiscal impact on this bill to the port, and we'd be glad to crunch the numbers and get that information back.
If I may follow.
One more.
And your sense is that if you force shippers to provide safe chassis, that would be a competitive disadvantage. Is that the position you're stating?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I wouldn't characterize my comments that way. I knew you were just checking. As I said before, I'm not sure we would argue that there isn't a problem here to be solved. Personally, I haven't researched this enough to fully understand the breadth of this, of the issue and the problem. And I think it is something, based on particularly Mr. DePonte's testimony, that does need to be addressed. As we have looked at this legislation, as it was presented to the interim committee in December, all the way to this point, we've really never engaged with proponents of the legislation to try and come up with any solutions that somehow was a consensus among the parties.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. More as a comment than a question, Keith. I think if it's an issue of safety, and I believe there is one here, there's a problem here that needs to be dealt with, but it goes across state lines. It's also, we're very close proximity to the port of Tacoma and the ports up in Seattle that are dealing with these. And so if there isn't laws and rules and regulations in place up there to deal with it, and there isn't here, the problem, it would appear to me to be, needs to be handled by the federal government. If that process is in going forward and moving ahead with it, then that needs to be the way that it's addressed, as opposed to us doing it here with our statutes or with this bill, it would appear to me.
Mr. Chair, I was also thinking in a sense that if
we really do want to pass this out or pass it over to the Senate to see if it can work something out, we might want to think about a sunset clause on it as well to see how it's worked and whether the federal rulemaking process is straightened.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. Any other comments? Thank you, Keith, for having me. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2039, and we recess, right?
Right.
Don't adjourn the recess. And we'll be in recess till...
Janet, will you give us really an explanation on what's taking place with a couple of the bills there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been quite a bit of activity since the 8:30 meeting. On House Bill 2749, that was discussed for a short time today, the sponsor, Representative Miller, is getting an additional amendment drafted that will take out any fire marshal regulatory role over the sale of the, making sure that that the gas is available at no more cost if you are over 55, and I believe that age is going to be raised to 65 in the amendments as well. So this bill would be back on Friday with the new amendments. And on House Bill 2685, this was a bill that there was a problem because the relating clause was pretty narrow and didn't fit the amendments. Legislative Council recommended that an entirely new bill be drafted, and we got permission from the Speaker's office to do that, so, and permission to work on that bill into next week. So that bill will come back in a new form next week, and there seems to be agreement on the amendments that will all be combined in a new bill. So that's the information on House Bill 2749 and House Bill 2685.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Committee, we're going. I'll start with the bill on the back side of our agenda. There, House Bill 2986. We'll open the public hearing on 2986. And Janet, can you give us a little bit of a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2986 is the bill that was heard on March 26th. And involves the mandatory reporting by doctors and healthcare providers of conditions that affect a person's ability to drive. The bill would make the current mandatory reporting requirement to a discretionary in line 15 of the bill. And the reason we're starting with this bill is that Holly Robinson from Legislative Council is here. Some questions arose about the application of the health privacy policy, something, the federal law that took effect yesterday, and how it affects discretionary reporting.
Health insurance affordability protection.
Thank you, Holly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council, and I've been asked to give you HIPAA in 25 words or less. And actually, HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, and HIPAA, when it was originally enacted, did not include the privacy regulations that went into effect on Monday. What HIPAA actually said was that if Congress could not pass laws addressing privacy of medical records, then the agency had authority to issue rules and regulations that would cover that area. And in fact, Congress failed to act and issued at least two sets of temporary or provisional or draft rules and regulations. And finally, there were final rules that went into effect on Monday of this week. Generally speaking, the rules address how medical information can be used and disclosed. That's kind of the basic. And who can release them, under what circumstances, and if they are released without a proper permission, There are, under federal law, significant civil and criminal penalties. Part of the reason why, and I think it makes a lot of sense, there's been a lot of attention by the provider community about these regulations, is that under state and under federal law, the penalties for noncompliance, the civil and criminal penalties, will be significant. HIPAA ends up addressing House Bill 2986 in this way, and it's really, this law is not the only law that, in fact, is affected in Oregon law. And the question really has to do with discretionary reporting of any private information or information that would be otherwise confidential of an individual to somebody without the individual's permission. And we have in Oregon law reporting requirements that will stay in place, mandatory child abuse reporting, mandatory elder abuse reporting, because what the federal law says is if it's mandatory reporting, if a doctor has to report, then under state and federal law, they still can. The HIPAA implications of this bill and other bills that this legislature has addressed comes if this assembly attempts to make it discretionary, because if the law says a person may disclose and there is not patient authorization, patient consent, and there is not a federal exception for that reporting, then there will be the potential of significant liability should one report and there is not a recognized exception in federal law that says you may report. Now, there has been some discussion as to whether or not the Department of Transportation is a public health authority for the purposes of this. And their Attorney General has advised them that for the purposes of this program, they are, which then would allow a mandatory report to be made. Conceivably, it may allow a discretionary report to be made, but if it's not a mandatory reporting, they're not going to get it anyway. I'm not sure that I agree with that interpretation, but I still think if it changes to discretionary, you run into a problem with HIPAA or a potential problem with HIPAA because it doesn't cleanly fit within an exception. I also have to say, I should have started this with a caveat. In my legislative career, I've been accused of many things, and having delusions of grandeur is not one of them. And there's no way one can be an expert at HIPAA on this point. So I am not here as an expert in any way. I'm only here to share what limited information I have as these rules start going into effect and people understand what they really mean. For those of you who are interested, I mean, I enjoy this part. These are the actual regs, about this much of this book, and the rest of this is the federal government's interpretation of what these regulations mean. So as you can see, there's quite a bit of room here. But the bottom line is, I think that if medical information is going to be disclosed, and it's going to be disclosed to somebody without patient permission, then it either needs to be a mandatory report, so therefore the provider does not have civil or criminal liability, or they don't, and I guess I should just put a period there, because federal law does say unless otherwise required by federal law, the reports can be made, and in this case, I think there would be a concern. And with that, I'll be happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you, Ollie. Questions, Representative Greenland.
I'm in trouble now. He's going to correct most of all that problem.
I'm not going to correct any of what you said, and I think the most important point you made is that we probably won't know until there's a lot of case law that decides all the things that are going to happen. No, I was going to ask you about ORS 807.710 that we have in front of us that we're talking about amending by making voluntary. Is it in its current form, given, for a moment, accepting the interpretation of the ODOT attorney, is it HIPAA compliant then as a mandatory requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, yes. Any state law that mandates a report, and there are a number of them in here, which control the behaviors of the provider. I mean, it's important in this universe to really to look at it from the perspective of the healthcare provider that's holding the information, as opposed to whom it's going to initially. And so then the question becomes, can it be released either with permission or can it be released because it's otherwise required by state or federal law?
So in this case, if the mandatory reporting requirement stayed in effect, it would then be required, otherwise required by state law, and the provider who's ever holding that medical information could in fact release it.
If I may follow up, my understanding is that there's a bunch of work that defines this that's been going on preparatory, and we may need to talk to ODOT about it, but preparatory to making this go in place, a bunch of lists and a variety of things. Is it safe to assume that if we leave this the same, those rules could come into place under the protection of a mandatory requirement? I mean, it could be a definition of mandatory, this disease, not this. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, if I understand your question and what little I have learned about this subject area in the last 24 hours, I think the answer is yes, that if ODOT is promulgating rules premised on the law as it currently stands, not as it is may or may not be amended here, that those rules, because they would fall back on this authority, would be enforceable.
Right, if I could follow up. Yeah.
Well, I made some assumptions in answering that question, so if my assumptions aren't accurate.
Well, I think the rules were being created with the intention to how to make a voluntary plan more clear and to differentiate what was the difference between voluntary and mandatory. I was asking, if we leave the bill the same, can they take those rules and apply them to the mandatory requirement that says here's the diseases, here's the not diseases, as long as it stays mandatory? I was carrying this one step further and trying to keep that work alive, but under the mandatory rather than under the voluntary model.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, if the reporting requirement stays mandatory, then the answer to your question would be yes. I would also point out to this committee that there are probably, outside of the well-known abuse reporting statutes, there are probably, I think, the Senate bill, SB 104 committee, which was the advisory committee on HIPAA that was created last session, probably identified 6 to 8 mandatory reporting requirements or discretionary reporting requirements that had existed in Oregon law pre-HIPAA that are not the well-known ones. There are a couple about people arriving in emergency rooms needing attention and whether or not the doctors in those cases can report that information. And the committee took a consistent position, which was those that were mandatory were not preempted under HIPAA. Those that were discretionary would, in fact, be preempted under HIPAA. And so the analysis in terms of a mandatory reporting, whether it's going to law enforcement or to ODOT or anybody else, has been done in the context of whether or not the report itself is required, not to whom it's going.
Yeah, this covers the reportable diseases under public health, which is where they thought about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, if we could avoid sort of going into the public health arena, it would make this conversation a little simpler.
Any other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on this, 2986? Certainly come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology, and our members are about 175 medical and osteopathic doctors specializing in eye care and surgery. Our members began to react to this bill when they saw the draft rules, began to react to the mandatory reporting, I should say. When they saw the draft rules earlier this year, they began to grasp the implications and reacted very strongly and very negatively, as negatively as I have seen them react to anything that has come out of the state. Their main concern is that they feel this will have will make a very profound change in the doctor-patient relationship, that it makes their role adversarial, and that patients actually will postpone getting eye care and treatment that they need because they will be afraid of being turned in to the state when they find out that indeed their physician, instead of advising them or encouraging them to curtail, not to drive or to curtail other activities, would have to turn them in. And that is their major concern, and why we support doing away with the mandatory reporting.
Representative Brown, Chair Brown, and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. We have some 345 members, which I represent, and I would echo what Nanheim has just indicated. I think, again, the ramifications did not become clear until our members started to actually participate in the hearing process as ODOT developed the rules. This type of a procedure significantly, and we think very detrimentally, impacts the relationship between the patient and a doctor, similar to what Nana has indicated. Our concern is that unless we make this voluntary, which in essence it is right now, it's going to create a real problem with regards to people seeking care, follow-up care that they need that is instrumental in their health. I'm not quite sure what approach to take on this other than the fact that, if nothing else, returning to the original bill and potentially repealing it, because I think at that time, again, we did not realize what the impact this would be and exactly what rules would be promulgated. And even though ODOT may come up with a short list, if you will, of conditions, there's nothing to support that they couldn't increase that, and it creates a problem. Our real concern is that in getting this information out to the public, it's going to be perceived somewhat differently than I think the intent may be, even from ODOT's standpoint. And that's our concern, that would create a mass panic in a population that tends to be extremely guarded about their health, and I think rightfully so, and that's the elderly population predominantly in our society. So with that in mind, I would ask the committee to consider that and the serious implications that this would have if we go forward with this kind of a rules process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Anderson here today, also representing the ophthalmologists, and I do support the OAO's position on this bill, as stated by Ms. Heim. What I'd like to do, though, is step back for just a moment and put another hat on that Representative Greenlick knows all too well that I wore just this time last year, and that's with the Oregon Medical Association. And as a member of the Oregon Medical Association, I was able to work on House Bill 3071 during the 2001 session with the DMV, and also able to work with the medical work group that was formed. To their credit, I might add, they put this work group together so that they could have a better approach at rulemaking process for House Bill 3071. The main issue going into this rulemaking process or this medical work group was the issue of liability for healthcare providers. And that issue is still there today. It hasn't been helped. If I could direct you to House Bill 2986, lines 16 through 18, you will notice the language from the bill that passed last session, House Bill 3071. What it says there, basically, is that if a doctor chooses to report, they are immune from civil liability. What it is silent on is if a doctor chooses not to report. If a doctor chooses not to report, they are liable for liable in civil cases. And there has been a case tried in Deschutes County. It was found in favor of the defendant, the doctor, and that just points up the problem that the doctors had going into this work group. two other issues surfaced when we got in there. One was addressed earlier, the physician or healthcare provider patient relationship. A third issue was addressed by Ms. Robinson of HIPAA, and the privacy issue. What does a doctor do with the patient's records? How do they divulge those records? How do they communicate with somebody on the outside about those records? That still is a very cloudy issue. It will be for some time. Like Representative Greenlick said, until we take this to court and it is challenged, we really won't have a clear picture of what it is that we're dealing with. And I think there's enough cloud around the privacy issue yet that doctors are very uncomfortable. They're very uncomfortable with this entire issue, quite honestly. They don't want to be policemen. They don't want to turn their patients into and over to an agency who will make the determination of whether or not they continue or can continue to operate a motor vehicle. We wrestled during the medical work group for some time with those three problems: HIPAA, physician-patient relationship, and the liability issue. And to my recollection, there has never been any resolution to this. As a matter of fact, the DMV was good enough to take me and my legal counsel aside in a separate meeting outside of the work group and discuss the issue of liability and privacy, both those issues. We came to no resolution. We couldn't resolve the issue. It was too big, and it remains very large, and it's encompassed in this bill and other bills that I believe the House has already addressed on privacy in this session. Again, I would simply state that I am here to support the OAO's position on this bill, and there is an amendment, I believe, in legislative council today that would simply add language to this bill that would include loss of consciousness. That would have to be something that needs to be reported by any health care provider to the DMV.
If I could just elaborate on that amendment. What the amendment does, frankly, is go back to pre-2001, restores loss of consciousness, and basically we start all over again, I guess, because I think, as Jim has said, there are an awful lot of unresolved issues and questions and a lot of very upset physicians. And I think those amendments, I hope, would be ready on Friday for that amendment.
And so, as this bill is now, you oppose this bill?
Well, actually, we supported it as introduced, yeah. We're just offering another alternative.
Okay. And you will like the amendments that are coming?
We think.
Okay.
I really would like to follow, because I am a little confused with what you say.
Yeah.
This is not a repeal of 807.710 in front of us.
This bill is not.
Which I hear you say that you might like to have, but it's this bill. So the question is, do you want us not to vote on this bill, or do you want us to vote on this bill in spite of what our legislative council said, or do you want us to wait for an amendment that's coming? And what's your position is what I'm trying to find out.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think the confusion reflects the fact that the issue is so complex. We support this bill. The question that Legislative Council raised is, we did hear about that late yesterday, and I've run that by my members, and I don't have a response yet. We did ask for the amendment simply to repeal the whole thing, just so that could be an option, because, and I guess that would be our first preference at this point.
Representative Mabry.
I guess I would like to think that someone would refuse to go to a doctor because they were afraid they'd be turned in as overstated, but I know for a fact that I've got an uncle that refused to go to a doctor because of that very thing. So I know that happens. I had a father that probably would have done the same thing, but he died too young. So I know that's a reality. But at the same time, during our previous testimony, we had people say, you know, there are really good and valid reasons to report things. Passing out, losing consciousness is one of them, and that doctors are in fact doing the right thing, because there are times that you know, our conscience just tells us that that's the right thing to do, and I respect that a great deal. But in light of what Holly said, it almost sounds like there would be such a fear of, if we didn't make something mandatory, and there would be such a fear of liability that even if you were convinced that my uncle was blind, you would refuse to make that report. And I think that's a valid concern. I'm really torn on this, but can you address that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, your points are valid. The fact is that providers to this point have been dealing with this issue, and there are a number of ways to deal with it. I myself, as an executive director, get calls at least twice a month where are there issues like this involved, and this, of course, is pre-HIPAA. Now they're even more concerned about what do they have the ability to do, what should they do. Ethically, it's a little bit different than what's required by HIPAA law or not required not to be disclosed. There are ways of dealing with this issue, counseling with the patient, making them aware of just how serious this is, also dealing with a spouse or next of kin, again, understanding the HIPAA allowances. In some cases, we've even talked with clergy members where that's an advisor, and they're saying, well, I kind of like to talk to my, you know, my clergy before I get involved in this. So the mandatory takes this completely out of it, this whole process of dealing with the patient in an individual basis. And mandatory, it puts as we've indicated, it puts the provider in the police arena, and that's going to create some problems, as you've just described. That's people not accessing the system because they're afraid. And I would support as well. Although we support this bill, we understand the ramifications that have come up about this and that are still essentially coming up about the original bill. And if we could return to pre-1999, we think that would be the ultimate solution to the immediate problem right now and provide a little bit more study, maybe coming back next legislative session with something that's a little more logical, depending on what the ramifications of HIPAA and all these other legal requirements. That's our problem, is I think we step a little too quickly.
Representative Greenwood.
Well, how do you feel about just leaving it alone as it is and coming back in the next session? I mean, working in the interim and trying to straighten it out. Because that is the question. Because the question is trying to fool around with it without certainty about HIPAA and without some other things. You think there's a chance that between now and the next session we can create the model that actually will work given HIPAA?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, I think the problem with leaving it as is that the medical community is so, I don't know if angry is the right word, but really worked up about this. Disturbed, it's a good word. And I think
we have the third voice in the medical community behind us now.
Pardon? I think we would find a more cooperative, collaborative effort if we went back to the way it was and started over. As it is, they feel under the gun. You are going to do this, and you will figure it out.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could underscore that a little bit. And having talked to some physicians about this, as I told you in my prior life, which part just walked into the room, and I hope he does have something to say along these lines. But back to the liability issue, I think it would be the tendency of a person, and it may be myself, if I was in a doctor's position seeing a patient, and I know I had in my mind what the outcomes might be if I chose not to report. What would I do? What would human nature tell me to do? I would report. I might report every patient that comes before me to try to avoid the penalties that I could be under and the liability that I could be under by not reporting. The bill that passed last session only addressed the immunity a doctor, a physician, would have if they chose to report. It was silent on not reporting, and they're still under that today. To go to a voluntary position would go a long way to remove that.
Representative Greenland.
Failing that, because of what we've heard about HIPAA, would you be comfortable with an amendment that only added the things on 18 to 21 to the existing statute to deal specifically with the liability issue? And that would be another interim measure, is simply add that 18 through 20 on page 1 to deal with the immunity to liability question, leave the others in place and work on it in the interim.
I would have to think about that. I'm not quite sure, and it's in that small context if that would be quite what we would want to do absent the amendment that we've got down in LC.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your testimony. Is there anyone else that wanted to? Tim, come on up, please.
No, it's not Scott. Scott's just here to watch Tim and make sure he doesn't screw up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. We are having copies run of an opinion from our counsel. The great thing about lawyers, of course, is there are about 11,000 of them practicing in Oregon, so we can get a different opinion any day of the week. Our counsel, though, and you'll see in this letter shortly, feels very strongly that there are no HIPAA issues here. I understand that Holly Robinson, Legislative Counsel, talked about whether or not you are, DMV is a public health agency, public safety agency, whatever the term of art is, and our counsel says even if they're not, and they would have to be proven that they're not, but even if they're not, HIPAA does make provision for this type of activity. So we don't see the HIPAA issue as relevant.
Mr. Chair? But the major point of her issue wasn't that. The major point of her discussion was that if it was a voluntary requirement rather than a mandatory requirement, it would be excluded from HIPAA. Did your counsel deal with whether HIPAA would exclude you from reporting under a voluntary program?
I believe it, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlink, I believe it does. And like I say, as soon as it comes back, we'll distribute that to the committee. Beyond that, what I wanted to say is the committee will recall when testified earlier on this bill that this obviously has been an important issue to the Oregon Medical Association for the last several years. We have been working with DMV to see if there is a way to come to some kind of resolution that makes both sides happy. At this point, we have not agreed on a way to do that. Are we closer than when we started? Probably so, I think. But whether or not we're going to get there is probably the big question. The more I get involved in this issue, the more I do hear from physicians and other medical provider groups of the concern in having this bill be implemented. They were involved on the committee that DMV set up, but most of them felt that it just didn't really go their way, I guess is one way of putting it, or that they weren't listened to as the folks that were going to be actually on the front lines on this issue. So while the OMA is not an official position at this point on those amendments, we do have a legislative committee meeting this Thursday. I understand you're planning on bringing this back for work session on Friday, and I would at least have a OMA position at that point.
Okay. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Kidder, Department of Transportation. I'll just try to be brief as possible because I know you have other things to work on. I just want to talk for a minute about pre-1999, because folks have talked about, let's go back to pre-1999. And pre-1999, I mean, the reason you all chose to change the law at that time was they were concerned that only loss of consciousness and loss of control were mandatory reported, and there were other issues that affect a person's driving ability that should be reported. And the first attempt at getting at that was to just simply require mandatory testing at a DMV at a certain age. And that approach was abandoned rather quickly when they realized that that just, you know, that's one way to get there, but you're having everybody come in at a certain age when it may be an earlier age something comes up, it may be a later age, and so that just simply wasn't the case decided. So that's why they had us do the study with the work group. They went all around the state, hours and hours and hours, this work group with stakeholders, et cetera, doctors, and everybody else involved, to come up with the bill from last time, which is the law today, which is those things that by rule, which according to the law we did with the work group that included physicians, et cetera, to identify those things that should be reported. And I want to mention that in rule, it's those things that are severe and uncontrollable. So it isn't just anything. It's severe and uncontrollable. And severe means substantially limits a person's ability to perform many normal daily activities, including driving, because it is not controlled or compensated for by medication, therapy, surgery, or adaptive devices. Severe does not include a temporary impairment for which a person is being treated by a physician or health care provider and which is not expected to last for more than 6 months. And uncontrollable means it cannot be controlled or compensated for by medication, therapy, surgery, or adaptive devices. And then it goes on to talk about which cognitive and functional things, gripping, numbness in extremities, not being able to sit up straight, things like that. And it's got to be severe and uncontrollable before it's mandatorily reported. So it's not that Kelly's diagnosed with a particular disease or something. It's Kelly has reached a severe and uncontrollable state. Now, this doesn't do away at all with anybody speaking to family or the clergy or the person themselves long before they get there when you're treating them and you're concerned about it. And I will say that when we had mandatory, we've always had mandatory reporting of some things and the rest being voluntary. And although, yes, some people probably do avoid going to doctors anyway, to my knowledge, they still sought help when they were having seizures or a loss of control or loss of consciousness because that's how we got the reports before. So I know that there are some people, but then there's some people that still will seek help when they're having medical problems. As for the rules, we have listened because when we had the public hearings on the rules, the eye specialists, the ophthalmologists and optometrists were concerned about the functional impairments that were relating to vision. That was the thing we kept hearing about. They wanted that list changed and narrowed, and so we are changing the rules. As we speak, we are taking in their consideration. We heard them. We are taking all of that out, except if your vision is beyond the minimum state minimum standards, which is a very clean, easy thing to know. If you're over 20/70, your vision, then you are beyond the, and it can't be corrected, not with glasses or something like that, or surgery or anything else. I mean, it's severe and uncontrollable. So we have addressed the ophthalmologist, optometrist concerns that were raised in the public hearings. So to say that, well, gee, they're going to change the rules now, but they might go back later, the law would still say, because it does right now, that if we're going to adopt any rules to do with this program, we do it with the help of physicians and healthcare experts. So even if we want to change the rules again in the future, we'd need to get their help. Even if we were going to try to beat them up, we'd need to get their help to do so and go back to the public hearing process. Now, I understand there's a lot of concern, and I understand that the people have been upset, and I think it's the unknown and unsure and what this is going to mean that feeds part of that. I know I don't care for change, and I get worried if I don't know what the facts are. When Lorna was here before you a few weeks ago, she mentioned that we were doing this in a very controlled set of pilots, you know, just little bit by little bit around the state, to do it in a small section, and what we're doing right now is we're doing from Lane County south and over to coast, there's about six counties down there, and it includes both rural and urban, you know, big and little and all of that. It's a good cross-section of folks. And we are down there, as we speak, we've been down there for the last few weeks. We're going literally town to town, small towns, large towns, going meeting with doctors. We have contracted with a nurse who worked for 20 years at the Salem Hospital and also is very, very familiar with the workers' comp issues, et cetera. She is helping us. We are meeting with physicians. We are meeting with senior centers. We are meeting with community folks to do training, which is what we say, because education is a big piece of this. clearing away the unknown, having them understand what exactly is in the rules, what the form looks like, very, very simple. And what we've been getting is very favorable response. In fact, in Cave Junction, the physician's office closed for the lunch hour, and other physicians came from in the different communities came so that they met together. And at that meeting, they were like, oh, okay, we see what it is. It is really a very specific type of time when we would get to someone being severe and uncontrollable and these things, and this is the form we fill out. I get it. And very appreciative. The same thing's been happening at the senior centers and community centers we've been going to. People have been very receptive and very grateful, thinking, well, something needs to be done because there are conditions other than passing out that could make you a danger on the road. And somebody, you know, we need to know. This does not take away from talking to families. It does not take away from talking to the patient ahead of time. It simply says, if it comes to this point, you need to report it. Now, when we last had the last hearing, we did work, like we told the committee we would. We met with the ophthalmologist. We had our AG there. We met with OMA to talk about what things we could do. Dr. Grant Higginson was there, the state health officer that you met. And he kind of has a dual role. He's a state health officer, but he's also part of OMA and part of their legislative committee, so he kind of has a foot in each camp. He also met with us, that same work group, and we did come up with some suggested amendments that we think would help clarify in the law, to help give that bolstering, I guess you will, of worrying about liability and dealing with the liability of what if you don't report. So we believe some amendments could be made to the current law that would address the issues of what if I don't report and some civil liability protection there, and also some clarification on when you really should report. So anyway, I just wanted to bring you up to speed, the fact that we are going around. I would ask that you let us continue to implement what you started us on the road for 4 years ago. We're that close to it, and it appears as we're going around and doing the training that a lot of the consternation and fears are going away, and people are actually embracing it and agreeing with it. So I would leave that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Kelly. Representative Zahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, you're really pumped up about this one. That's the most excitement I've seen in quite a while. I can understand it, too, though. I have four children, and when I put a plate of broccoli in front of them and they said, Dad, I don't like that, I said, well, try it. You might like it. And that's how I feel about this bill. You know, they passed it in 99. We've not tried anything. We've done all this work. So I can understand your frustration from that standpoint. We haven't really tried it. And
no,
that's why I'm having trouble from it. It has nothing to do with broccoli. And by the way, they do love broccoli now.
They did like it.
Only with ranch dressing.
Is there any other questions? Tim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez again. I appreciate your comments, Representative Zahner. And again, I think looking at it from the medical community, though, the liability issue is huge. We're not looking for another way to create problems with liability. Those are already rampant in the state as we sit here today, and you know we're in a major crisis on that piece. I think the frustration. I don't think it's the kids and the broccoli. I think the frustration is. The medical community did try to walk down this path in good faith through the legislation, through the task force, and at the end of the day, think that by and large their concerns have not been adequately or appropriately addressed. And that's what caused us to introduce the bill before you. The OMA at this point has no problem continuing working with DMV on this, but we are in a session that the leadership on both sides wants to go home. We'd hate to see this bill not be able to move forward because of time constraints. So we, again, will have a position for you Friday morning, but at a minimum, we'd like to see the bill move forward to continue the discussion on the other side. I mean, it is a bicameral process, and we can. This wouldn't be the first bill this session that would go the other side to be continued to work on.
Do you have some amendments coming, Tim?
We don't at this point, Mr. Chairman. Again, our legislative committee meets tomorrow night.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenland.
Tim, let me try the same thing out on you. I tried on Nan and Jim, and maybe you could take it to the committee. Would you be comfortable as an interim with a bill that only had the bolded lines on 18 through 20? it dealt very specifically with the non-reporting liability question. It seems to me that might be a good first step, and we might ask for that kind of amount, too.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlich, I'd certainly take that back to the LMA, to the committee.
Because that could be, first, to deal with the liability issue and not deal with the other things. See if that works. Does that take a, if we were to have that in front of us on Friday, a -1 amendment that would only do that, that would eliminate all the other changes in here? Is that a feasible thing for us to have as one of these to consider on Friday? It's Jan, I thought, do I guess.
Me?
Yeah, well, my question is, I mean, there are two different issues here. One is the issue of making it voluntary. The other is the issue of dealing with liability for non-reported. And I was wondering if one of the things we might be considering, if we're going to reconsider the bill on Friday, an amendment that only did the addition in lines 18 through 20 and did not do the other additions and deletions.
And I can get that turned in this afternoon as a committee request.
And if that makes sense, because I really feel sort of the way Representative Zahner does, that it's really worth giving this a try, but I'm sensitive to the liability issues that are being raised here, and if that turns out to be a satisfactory alternative for us to consider, I'd like at least as one of the things we could consider on Friday.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, folks, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, quickly, I'm trying to get my mind around this, that if you take this little piece out of there, and there is, it's not like I want to penalize anybody, but if there is no consequence to reporting, what would make somebody, I mean, this isn't mandatory reporting anymore.
This is civil liability issues. Line 18 through 20 is about civil liability.
Right.
It's about if you didn't report and somebody got in an automobile accident, would you then come back with civil liability on the physician for not having reported? And I think that's a different kind of issue.
Thank you. I do see what you're saying, but I still kind of wonder about that. And maybe it isn't an issue, but.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, if I might, that is one of the things that when we had our Attorney General there trying to come up with ways to keep the intent of the law the way it is, which is mandatory reporting for the severe and uncontrollable impairments, but also to give some more protection for risk of liability. And also, if they did not make a report and there was, you know, it's because it's in good faith. I mean, that's why it says, you know, if they make it in good faith, you know. And we believe we've come up with some language that would do that. And it may be that this line on its own would do that. I would be happy to talk to my Attorney General about that. So I know that there's always been mandatory reporting, and I realize it was with loss of consciousness and loss of control. But I don't know of a lot of litigation that happened because of that. We are absolutely understandable to the concern and have been trying to, again, come up with language that would do that, but yet keep the intent of the program going so that we could see. And that's why we're doing it in very small increments, and we'll adjust the program as we go and can adjust the rules as we go. That's exactly why we're doing it in small groups like that and not doing it statewide. To be very, very careful.
Thank you. Thank you again, Kelly and Dan. Appreciate that. Is there anyone else that have any testimony on that? No. Don't look like there is. Well, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2986. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2388. And Janet, can you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that was introduced at the request of the of Monty King that would have required registration plate to stay with the vehicle owner and not be transferred or kept with the vehicle. But there's a dash one amendment that would delete all those provisions. So the dash one amendments are a gut and stuff of the original bill. And the amendments would require a vehicle dealer to remove the date tags or the stickers that go on your license plate before selling a vehicle. It would provide an exception for dealers that submit title and registration documents to DMV on behalf of owners. So then in that case, they wouldn't have to scrape the stickers off because the owners would, they know the owners are going through the title registration process. This would necessitate the buyer of the vehicle purchasing a 10-day trip permit from the dealer in order to allow operation of the vehicle until their new registration tags were obtained. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out to you that the Business and Labor Committee passed a bill, House Bill 2383, that I don't believe has made it to the floor yet, but in amendments to that bill, it requires towing businesses to scrape off the stickers that when they're selling a vehicle. So I just wanted to make sure that you knew that that bill was proceeding. And I wanted to also point out that the changes on the dash one amendments are mainly on the first page. The rest of the bill is about the trip permits, and I think that's in a bill that's already moving forward out of this committee about dealers, again, being able to sell 10-day trip permits. Right now they have to sell 30-day trip permits. So, Mr. Chair, there's a representative to discuss the bill.
Okay. Representing buyer.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate your letting me bring this up. When I have been working on 2455 and working with the towers, trying to resolve that issue, and I know that there were some amendments put into another bill, the 2383, that tightened up some of their requirements. And this was one of the pieces that was in there. And I felt that as a matter of fairness, that this is something that, and also I think it certainly helps deal with unlicensed people out there without insurance and accurate titles on their cars. I certainly have been a thorn in Monty King's side on this issue. So I did check with all the sponsors of the bill and let them know what my intentions were, and they were all fine with it, thought it was a fair idea. And that's the premise that I was going on, is that I thought that this kind of created a level playing field. And have had conversations with Monty, knew his concerns with the bill, and so that's where I am now.
Thank you, Representative. Could I have Kelly Taylor first, please, come up?
Mr. Chair, I want to be sure people have the amendments. We passed them out at the end of this morning's meeting, so they're the 2388-1 amendments. I have other copies if you don't.
I don't have it, I'm sure. I'm sure I have it in my office.
I do.
Thank you.
I've got it. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Cater, Department of Transportation, and I too have been working with all parties on this issue and would dearly love to settle it and put it to bed and work on something else. But this bill, the dash ones, are very, very similar to provisions that are in the other bill. So it is the same theory. And it is the majority, I want you to know, the majority of titles that are handled or cars that are sold through dealerships, they do the paperwork. Dealers handle about 40% of the titles that we see come through them, and about 80% of them do the paperwork. So it's the remaining 20% that the person either pays cash or such a low-end vehicle or whatever that they can pay cash and then they walk off and they can do the paperwork themselves. And since the concern has been with low-end vehicles and people buying them for the plate and the registration, both in the other bill and in this bill, that would be taken care of. And, you know, and if the person says, oh, wait a minute, you're going to scrape the stickers off, never mind, you can, you know, here, do the paperwork, great. I mean, it just gets the DMV that much faster. If they don't, they've got 10 days. And so that takes away that temptation to not do the paperwork, not put the car in your name, drive around and it looks like it still belongs to Kelly Taylor and maybe under Kelly Taylor's insurance and everything else, and then Kelly Taylor gets all the parking tickets or anything else that happens. This will stop that. Because they'll have 10 days. 10 days to drive legal, and guess what? Then they got to get into DMV. And we've got offices that are open on Saturdays and late hours and things like that, so that makes it easier for them to get in. So this does create the level playing field and get at some of those issues you all have been wrestling with.
Thank you, Kelly. Could you comment on the physical report? Do you have it there?
Mr. Chair, I did talk with LFO a little bit, and I told what I told them. I understand they've got indeterminate, it's my understanding. And that's because of those 20% that we think the paperwork isn't done, we know some number don't do the title, but there's no real way to know. We can use a 50-50 and say, well, gee, if 50% aren't, 50% aren't, how many does that make? And that's what we did with the other bill, the 2383, because we don't know. There aren't any records. We'll know after this because we'll see how many people are doing trip permits, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's why they said indeterminate. If it's 50%, it could equal some FTE or whatever. This is one of those where we'll just have to come back and report to you, and if it ends up being some extra workload, we'd have to come back to the e-board and talk about it. I will tell you this. Even with additional workload, it makes more revenue than expenditures because the title fees and stuff would be coming in. If it were, say, a 50-50 type of thing, the revenue could be as high as 2.4 in a full biennial. 2.4 million, excuse me. You got to say what I'm talking about. So, I mean, this would bring in revenue more than expenditures, even at the 50-50, but we'll wait and see.
Thank you. Is there any questions for Kelly? Thank you, Kelly.
Okay.
Monty, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty King, Executive Director of Oregon Independent Auto Dealers. And first I'd like to request my name be taken off the bill.
Okay.
We don't know how it got on there, but all that whole series of bills all had my name on them, and I don't remember putting it on the greenback, but whatever.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I found out from the Chief Clerk's office that you need to write a letter to them, and they'll take it off the next time the bill's printed, so it can be a brief letter.
Does that mean you don't love it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlink, that doesn't mean that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to have a meeting tomorrow afternoon with our legislative committee for the association. I have contacted four or five of the people on it already. There does not seem to be any opposition in the dealer community to do this. We have discussed how to get people to title and register and have their vehicles on the highway with insurance for a couple years now. And we've gone through a lot of ideas, and you've seen some of those in this committee. We still believe the best way is to have the plates move with the owners, though. That would get you 100% of these people. This will get you up to maybe 50% along with House Bill 2383. I think it will get you in our society a long way to where it should be, to trying to get these people off the highway that don't have insurance and aren't driving vehicles title registered in their name. So in that respect, this is a very good thing. I don't know the technical problems it might cause some dealers, but we can charge the people the $10 for the trip permit. And maybe they'll work it out in the deal they're making. But however it happens, I'm not anticipating, and it would not hold the bill up for that answer from our legislative committee. If there are serious objections, I can try and deal with that on the Senate side. If I may digress just a minute.
Sure.
I think it's been mentioned, we've been talking about the other bills in question that we're doing. I think 2383 is still a good bill. Everything in there should still go. I do have a little concern about the only one trip permit in this one because of DEQ. Sometimes vehicles need to go back again and again. And right now, when we used to have the 10-day trip permit, we could issue three of them only in the case of DEQ failures where the dealer was going to fix the car, and sometimes it took a couple trips. But I think we can deal with that, with conflict amendments or whatever. And I think everybody might have heard by now that we have agreed with Mr. Elkins and Mrs. Elkins on all of our issues and all of our numbers and all the tow bills questions. And these to me are a package of bills. And so at this point, we can include this one in those package of bills to make our whole industry better and to have the state better. So at this point, I don't have any objection to the bill, except for my name being on it.
Thank you, Monty. Any questions?
Thank you, Monty. I appreciate that. And I know that in our discussions, we discussed the private sales and the issues there, and while I certainly would like to get there, I think that's probably out of our realm at this point in time, but I'd love to work with you on that in the future and see if there's anything we can come up with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byers, I would like to compliment both Representative Byers and Representative Brown on their leadership in helping us resolve our policy issues. That's what this place is for, and Representative Close also worked very well, I think, with everybody, and we're there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I have Brian Daugherty, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee, and Representative Beyer. I guess I was not one of the people at the table that started with this whole process, and now I seem to be in it. Brian Daugherty representing today the insurance auto auction folks, and this is a auction company that sells almost exclusively salvage title vehicles. These are totaled vehicles that insurance companies, for whatever reasons, total and then send to them, and they are auctioned off, many to all these folks behind me and others. And I have not had an opportunity to talk with them about these amendments, and I am trying to do so. And I'm here today saying that, in general, I agree, and I think our client would agree with the purposes of this bill and these amendments. One of the questions I had is we primarily sell to other dealers, not to the public. And I'm wondering if a sale to another dealer needs to have this action taken. We have a volume of these cars, and some we take with title, some we simply pick up where the insurance company asks us to tow it from, sell it without having sell it on consignment, and then the insurance company sends the title to that new dealer. I don't know if that's the way to go, and I don't want to slow up things on this side, but it's a thought that we might talk about. But I still need to talk to my client and find out their concerns with this. It's a very different way, and their operation is very different than the typical sale to consumer.
And Brian, are these cars, do they rebuild them? Then
some of these cars are drivable. They're simply so old that whatever damage was on it was going to cost more than the car was worth, and they simply paid it off.
Yeah.
Some are undrivable. Many of them are total wrecked vehicles that are sold to dismantlers or wrecking yards or yards that want to have just for the parts. They'll never be running again. Others are for rebuilders that rebuild.
We can tell they're not wrecking less. They're auto recyclers.
That's the word? Auto recyclers. Excuse me. That's a wonderful euphemism.
Thank you, Brian. Is there any questions for Brian?
I don't really have a question. Maybe of Kelly, if this is something that maybe we had covered in this, or whether it's an issue we have to deal with.
Chair Brown, Representative Byer, I want to add one thing. We have a vehicle dealer certificate. We have a tower certificate. We have a wrecking certificate. So we have all those certificates.
Mr. Chair, Kelly Kidder, if I might, if Mr. Daugherty's clients are filling out the paperwork and sending it to DMV, because Daryl Fuller had this question, if they're filling out the paperwork to send to DMV, then they don't have to be taking stickers off. So dealer or not, if you're as an agent doing the paperwork, then you're not taking stickers off. And I don't know whether you are or not.
Chair Brown, I don't know either. I think some of them we do take title from the insurance company. Others we don't take title, and I don't know what we do in terms of the services we provide the insurance company. My understanding was the insurance company would be sending title directly to the person that acquired the vehicle from us, and we simply are doing the sale transaction and then moving forward. But we may be handling the title work as well. I understand there's an exemption here for...
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to continue to work with Brian, and if we need a clarifying amendment on the other side, we'll certainly get it, and I'm sure you guys would concur, you know, if we've worked it all out.
Bonnie, you have something to add?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Monty King, Oregon Independent Auto Dealers. A salvage vehicle cannot be driven on the highway. Any vehicle that has a salvage title is not on the highway no matter what. It seems to me that if those vehicles still have those registration plates and tags on the car and it is under a salvage title, somebody's done something wrong already. Because by definition, you cannot register a salvage title vehicle. I'm sure. Yeah. So I don't think there's that big a problem. In subsection 2 on line 13, there probably should be some kind of a notation of the buyer who is not a vehicle dealer or, you know. What we're trying to get at is somebody who's buying it for their use in their business or for their personal household use, that type of thing. I don't think we're trying to get at a wholesaler selling to another wholesaler having to do that. I don't think anybody in the room wants that. Well, we can fix that on the Senate side. I think everybody can agree with that.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Brian. Al Elkin does.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I'm not the brightest bulb on the title marquee, but or the title transfer marquee, but I do know a close friend when I see one, and I just wanted to thank Representative Beyer for doing all that you've done in relation to this. I really appreciate it. We brought these forth after discussion in our work group chaired by Representative Betsy Close in 2383, and what we're attempting to do here is level the playing field and close the circle so that, especially in the case of abandoned vehicles and those that we tow directly to the wrecking yards or the auto recyclers, our board believes that in 3 to 5 years, we'll go from now 10 out of 10 not being titled properly. We might go to 5 out of 10 being titled properly, or maybe even 2 out of 10. That's our hope. We think in the long run, everyone will benefit from this and everyone will win. So we appreciate the opportunity again to work with Representative Beyer on these amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Hope I can. Thank you again. So we're just in public hearing. Close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2388. And I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2388.
Representative Beyer moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2388. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2388 as amended to the floor with a 2-pass recommendation.
Representative Beyer moves House Bill 2388 as amended to the floor with a 2-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Excuse.
Representative Connor.
Excuse.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. And need a carrier on the floor.
Uh-uh.
Representative Byer. Thank you. And I want to thank everyone who's involved in putting this together. To be commended. Let's see, I'm going to open our work session on House Bill 2455 just to take a couple of comments, and there's some amendments coming, I believe, also.
Representative
Byer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have worked hard on this issue, and we have come to an agreement with all the parties that are involved in it. We don't have the amendments yet. They'll be ready on Friday that we can look at. Sign off from all members. Basically, what this one will do is that it will exempt towers and repairs from having a dealer's license that... Now I have to remember all this, but for all sales, all through foreclosure sales, through seller consignment to licensed vehicle dealers, sell to wreckers, and sell to crushers. And then after that, they are going to, they have a limit of 12 vehicles that can be sold a year at their business location. And that will exempt them under all these conditions, they are exempted from having a dealer's license. And hopefully I did that right, but you can.
Thank you, Representative.
It also keeps the, keeps the provision that their records have to be opened, and then we can look at them. So.
Could I get Al and Deb and Monty to nod their head? Yes, that sounds great.
You didn't ask me.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Tow Truck Association, and for the record, I'm sitting next to Monty King. Again, we wanted to thank Representative Byer for the work that she's done on this and brought all parties together and hammered out the agreement. Without her, we would not be here today. So we're looking forward to Friday and getting the bill out of committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty King, Oregon Independent Auto Dealers, and I'll let you be made aware that I'm sitting next to the Elkins. And we've had everybody out in the hallway and shaking hands in front of everybody and signed off on it. And, Representative Byer, that's my copy next to you. That's the only one I have that we were just given, so I would like that back. But
okay.
As you can see from that, we've all signed on. And as I said before in a previous testimony, this is part of the package of the different bills. We do still want 2383. We still want the trip permits, however they're going to go. We can fix technical stuff on that one. The 6890 bill, which is the notice bill, that's part of the package too. And I believe that with and the 2388, I think we've got the best package you've probably seen in a long time. It's actually going to bring a lot of money in, and I think it will make a significant difference to the tune of $50 to $100 million a biennium in the cost of public safety in this state. And I know that's a big figure, but the people who are not registering title in their vehicles of all kinds, whether it's from dealers, tow operators, or private parties, they're the ones that are causing the havoc out there on the road. And they're the ones not being insured, driving while suspended, whatever. And that's where our public safety people are spending a lot of their time. I think these series of bills, have far greater impact than all of us can possibly imagine. The cost of human lives, bodies, loss of income tax, public safety money. This all goes a lot farther along the way than just maybe what we've been discussing out here in the hallways and talking about. So this is terrific work by the legislature, Representative Brown, Representative Byer, Representative Close, and all the representatives who have worked on this.
Thank you, Monty. Deb, did you have some comments?
I do. For the record, my name is Deb Elkins, and I'm with the Northwest Automotive Trades Association. I just want to thank you for this opportunity to work through this process. This has been I've learned a lot, and I truly appreciate Representative Byer and Representative Brown for their willingness to keep at this issue with us. We needed something out of this legislature to help us go forward, and I think we have created some great policy here that has brought industry together, which has been my greatest concern, is industry was at industry, and I think we've accomplished a great deal through this process, and I'm very excited that we are given some we're given some limitations that I think my folks are very pleased that they can live within, and the consumers at the same time are getting some protection as well. So just thank you, and look forward to seeing Representative Brown on the floor with this bill and have a chance to really be the hero in this one. So thank you.
I can't stand all this.
I know. One last comment. I have to give so much thanks to Joan Robinson down in LC, who has just put up with misery from us. And without it, we couldn't have done this. So I simply want to make sure she gets the accolades.
Thank you, Representative.
And Kelly Taylor, too. Yeah. Thanks,
and Kelly.
Kelly
Taylor. Oh, yeah. I forgot Kelly.
Thank each one of you. I really appreciate what
Thank you.
And I appreciate the help that Representative Beyer put into this. She did a great job. And with that, we'll close the work session on 2455. And Janet, let me. Yeah, I'm going to I need unanimous consent to waive the rules to allow Representative Dingfelder to vote on House Bill 3187.
I so move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman. Yeah, that's what I'm headed the right way. Representative Gilman moves that the wait for the rules be waived to allow Representative Dingfelder to vote on House Bill 3187. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative Dingfelder, how do you vote?
I vote aye, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. I was off defending my SUV disconnect bill in the revenue committee.
Representative Dingfelder votes aye. And any other... Oh, yeah, 8 o'clock Friday, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah, 8 o'clock in the morning. And with that, we'll be adjourned.